has come to fruition for Australia. They have what they came for. It's the World Cup title.
Australia are going to go back-to-back in the T20 World Cup. England have finally won a test, and there are going to be no international players left to play in the Big Bash. Nick, pretty small week of news, but we are back for Season 4, Episode 2 of the Boundary Rider podcast. A lot going on this week.
Well, firstly, State of Origin was last night, and you yourself were there writing for Code Sports. What did you think of the game? The Blues, unfortunately, going 1-0 down in the series already.
Look, as a proud New South Welshman, I've always been a Blue. Walking into that Queensland dressing room last night, you just got the sense of why they're so good. There were just legends, not only plastered on the wall, but sitting among them. And you just go, we'll never have that. Queensland just have that culture that we'll never have. And it's sad, but they give us hope every year. And that's something that New South Wales should be given a lot of credit for, because time and again, they don't live up to it.
And I think before we get into the cricket, happy birthdays in order for yourself. What is it, your 27th is this week?
Thank you. Yes, 27. So hopefully many more returns to come. But at the age where the knees are starting to go, back starting to feel sore. So yeah, those years are ticking along very nicely at the moment.
Oh dear. Okay, hopefully your back's recovered in time for cricket season, because we need you. Oh. We need your right arm steady seam in the local village cricket of Northbridge Cricket Club. We need it.
Steady seam is such a nice way of saying slow mediums. I appreciate that from you. Let's get into some actual cricket chat that are performances worthy of talking about besides my slow mediums, because Australia, they have gone 2-0 up in their T20 series against Sri Lanka. Some great performances with the ball. Sri Lanka have just not had a chance batting first. And yeah, the second game, not as comfortable, a few wickets lost, made it look a little bit more difficult than it was. But I guess compared to some performances in recent years, two comfortable wins to start the series.
Well, yeah, the first T20 was a genuine demolition. There was a collapse of 9 for 28 for the local Sri Lankans, which, considering they were 1 for 100 in the 12th over, they were in such a great position at that stage. And it looked as though Australia were in some trouble. But then a really dire collapse, thanks mostly to Josh Hazlewood, all of a sudden the best pace bowler in T20 cricket in the world. And then, Finch and Warner. Firstly, how great is it to see Aaron Finch in the runs again? Mm. Obviously, plenty of talk and speculation about his place in the T20 side. But I think we can both agree now that he should be in that T20 World Cup squad later this year. It's great to see him back in the runs. And Warner, you know, it was vintage Warner, very destructive. And they chased it down with 10 wickets in hand. So an embarrassing one-sided first game. But the second game, I'm not sure how much of it you saw last night, Locke, obviously because of the Origin match, but that run chase was anything but convincing from the Australians. Another great start from Warner and Finch, but then that middle order was looking pretty ordinary. It was circa sort of June 2021 middle order stuff, a bit of another collapse in an Asian pitch sort of thing.
Mm. Well, obviously Hasaranga finally kind of bounced back after not being able to do much in that first game, 4 wickets for him, but yeah, just lots of little contributions or runner ball scores. And while they got over the line, if Sri Lanka get 20-odd, 30-odd runs more and put on a competitive total, it's a completely different game. But yeah, I think you're right. Josh Hazlewood has been fantastic again. 4 wickets in the first game, none for 16 off 4 overs against Sri Lanka in the second game, which is just as important. Like, being able to go for 4 runs and over in a T20 game is pretty incredible. I think, obviously, special shout-out to Kane Richardson has come in and has bowled pretty well in both games, took 4 wickets in the second T20 match. But, yeah, just they've never been able to – well, Sri Lanka have never been able to get away, and that's been the important thing for the Aussies, that they've been able to keep that economy rate low and then eventually start with that wicket-taking pressure, which has been really good. Now, the big talking point out of these first two games that I know is one that you're particularly invested in, one that we're both invested in, is – the role of Steve Smith in T20 cricket. They are pushing him up to 4 last night when he had a bit more time to have a bat, and he only made 5 off 4 deliveries. Isn't doing much in the field. He dropped a tough chance in the first game as well. But Nick, you've looked at the numbers a little bit more of Steve Smith in T20 cricket. What are your thoughts?
Well, we can't deny Steve Smith's talent. He is extraordinary both with the bat and in the field. But I feel like recently in the past couple of years, he's had that sort of anchor role in T20 cricket. He's sort of been sent in to save an innings or to get the run chase done. But leading into this series against Sri Lanka, there was discussion and talk about the fact that Steve will finally have a bit of freedom to actually play his natural game and be attacking when he wants to be. And he's only had that one chance so far, obviously because he wasn't required in the first game. He only had the second T20 and he looked pretty ordinary. He, you know, he scratched his way to five before being trapped plum LBW and wasting a review. But no, since the pandemic, in the T20 format, Steve Smith has been very ordinary, just by the numbers. He's averaging around 17, a strike rate just a touch over 100. And it's becoming very difficult to validate his spot in the starting 11 with the likes of Tim David and Cameron Green scoring a lot of white ball runs in domestic competitions around the world. I mean, we were just talking before recording. Tim David got another match-winning 60-odd in the T20 Blast last night. And I just can't help but feel that with him at number five or number six in the Australian side, it looks so much stronger. And I don't know, what are your thoughts? Do you think, obviously, Steve will play this third T20 against Sri Lanka, but if he can't convert that opportunity into runs, coming to the home summer in October, we might be looking at maybe a change in the guard.
I think so. I think it definitely felt like this series and maybe one or two of the series before the World Cup, Steve Smith will be given a chance to show why he should be selected. But you look at Tim David's form at the moment, it's just, you can't not pick someone like that when he's regularly blasting 60s at a strike rate of 200. That is the sort of guy you need in your team, especially if you want to win a World Cup and you want to go back-to-back in a T20 World Cup. Obviously, Tim David hasn't had as much of a chance to show that on home conditions. He's played well for the Hurricanes, but I think it's fair to say his best cricket has come this year in England, in Pakistan, and obviously the IPL, the back end for Mumbai as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see whether the Australian selectors are willing to give him a chance and to go, look, you haven't played for Australia yet. Let's get you into one of those couple of T20 series up in Townsville or before the World Cup starts later this year. And that might be where he gets his chance and he makes his run for the World Cup, because at the moment, who would have thought we'd say this 12 months ago, but Tim David needs to be selected ahead of Steve Smith.
I mean, it was only 6-7 months ago that national selectors made the decision to drop Elise Perry from the T20 side, which honestly was a massive call at the time. I mean, obviously Elise Perry is an icon of the game, but I think in hindsight, it was the right call. She just wasn't putting the performances together at domestic and international level. Obviously, Perry is still first choice in the Test and ODI side. And I think maybe the men's selectors, George Bailey and his group, needed to have another tough discussion about, you know, what role Steve Smith needs to play. Is it possible for someone like him to be representing Australia in all three formats still? It's difficult for any player to do that with the congested calendar we see. So, yeah, I mean, for the sake of Steve Smith, hopefully he scores some runs. But the fact that he doesn't play a lot of Big Bash cricket, he doesn't play a lot of IPL cricket because obviously he wasn't purchased by any of the IPL franchises this year. He doesn't really have a lot of opportunity coming up to rediscover that short format form. But as you know, Locke, I'm biased. I'm a huge Tim David fan, so it's difficult for me to be fair to Steve Smith in this discussion.
Well, I think the really interesting comparison is Joe Root. Obviously, one of England's best ever batters, was a great short form batter as well, but he's kind of taken a step back from the T20 side and his test cricket has really flourished as a result. He's been able to focus on the red ball stuff and he had a calendar best year last year. And I'd be very interested to see if Steve Smith can have a similar sort of impact. If it might not necessarily be his choice, but if he's given that opportunity to take a step back from T20 cricket and focus on test cricket, that we can finally see him back in the centuries and things like that, because admittedly, his form at that level has been great the last sort of 12, 18 months either.
Yeah, absolutely spot on. And just wrapping up this Sri Lanka series, great to see Andrew McDonald back with the Australian squad after his COVID scare. He was in the stands for that second T20 and both Richardsons took career best bowling performances in the second T20 as well, with Kane taking four and Jai taking a three first. So, and Matthew Wade just guiding the Aussies home with a nifty little, what was it, 26 not out, I believe, going at basically a runnable. So a few little exciting little stories there in the Aussie camp.
Yeah, very nice. And some good stuff coming out in terms of Warner sharing his messages, he said, to Finch about helping get his rhythm back. And yeah, it'll be an important series, I think, for the Aussies to get some momentum going. And of course, the last match of that series is on Saturday before the ODI series starts on Tuesday. But a little bit down the road from them, the Australia A team took on Sri Lanka A in their first game of their sort of tour matches. And unofficial ODI, make of it what you want, but Cam Green. Show us your shirt again, Nick. Let's see your shirt. Go on.
Not sure how good this camera is, but we've got the Lachlan McCurdy designed. It ain't easy being green. Which I absolutely love.
Admittedly, he makes it look easy, though. He makes it look very easy.
Admittedly, I use it as a pajama shirt, so I just sort of exposed the fact that I just rolled out of bed this morning. But
You rolled out of bed with Cam Green.
an unbeaten 119 for him against Sri Lanka A. 3 sixes, 9 boundaries, reaching 100 off 90-odd balls. It was probably the best I've seen him in short-format cricket, to be honest, like against the white ball. He looked fantastic. And look, I'm not saying watch out Marcus Stoinis, but there's going to be a discussion about Cam Green ahead of next year's World Cup.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I don't see him having an impact in T20 cricket yet. He's obviously got the power for it, but he just hasn't quite been able to translate it to that format. But certainly one day cricket, we've seen a few knocks for WA where he's just been able to come in late and use his power. Often he comes in at 6 or 7, which is just bizarre, but it shows how strong the Western Australian lineup can be. But yeah, it was very good from him to be able to show that class and come in with an attacking mindset, which was really nice. Matty Renshaw also in the runs, a nice 68, while Alex Carey had an unbeaten half century. Concerningly, the fielding wasn't great from our Aussie A side, but it was good to see the untried spin trio, Kuhneman, Todd Murphy and Tanvir Sanger all get a bowl and all look pretty decent. I don't think Tanvir didn't get any wickets, but for the most part, the three of them looked pretty good.
Well, of course, as the Sri Lankan broadcasters called him, Matthew, probably, presumably because they don't know how to spell Kuhneman. I mean, who would? But I thought Todd Murphy was actually the standout for me. Yeah. He was fantastic for a young 20-year-old. He's played, you can count on your fingers how many first-class games he's played, but all three of them were quite impressive. Tanvir being the leg spinner, a little bit more inconsistent with his line and length, which is understandable for any young leg spinner. I thought it was a really impressive performance all round, except for some of the ground fielding, as you mentioned. Not up to scratch, but let's just put that down to jet lag.
Yeah, and just wrapping up what's happening in Sri Lanka, Sean Abbott, unfortunately, coming home, suffered a bit of an injury while batting in the nets, and Pete Hanscom also coming home to be with his pregnant partner for the birth of their first child. So two sort of changes there. Scotty Boland and Jimmy Pearson heading over. Scotty Boland obviously was going to be in the Test Series, but heading over a bit earlier to join up with the Australia A guys. Plenty to keep an eye on over there. Lots happening, ODIs, T20s, and then eventually Test cricket in a couple of weeks. So it's going to be an interesting series to see how that goes, but Australia certainly looking on top to start with. Now, the other big sort of clash going on at the moment, Nick, England versus New Zealand, the first test over at Lord's. England finally got a win, and look, it was a low-scoring affair. It had a bit of everything. It had a lot of empty seats because of the Queen's Jubilee celebrations, which is funny to see, but yeah, England finally get that win on the back of Joe Root's heroics. What were your big takeaways from that test match?
Oh, it was a brilliant test match. It really fluctuated throughout the 3.5 days. It seemed to sway so heavily to one side than the other at multiple points. You have to cast your mind back to day one. New Zealand was 7 for 45 in that morning session, 7 for 45. But by the end of the day, the test match was in the balance. It was just such a bizarre contest. But obviously the standout was Joe Root, who with one leg glance simultaneously reached his century, his first in the fourth innings of a test, and brought up 10,000 test runs, becoming just the second English player to achieve that. We spoke last week about how we were a bit concerned about whether giving up the captaincy would affect his batting, but not at all. In fact, if anything, he looked more focused, had more freedom at the crease. And yeah, I mean, people are already talking about, is he going to catch up with Sachin Tendulkar's all-time test runs tally record? So look, he was obviously the standout. James Anderson, 4 wickets in the first innings, and Stuart Broad with absolutely ferocious spell in the second innings to turn the match on its head. And England's back. Their second win in 18 games, I think.
What would you say to Colin de Gronholm about that run out? If you had him in the sheds after his walk in, he's walked down the tunnel, back up the tunnel at Lord's, back up the steps, and you go, Colin, what were you thinking? What would be the first thing you say to him?
He was genuinely flustered by the crowd, I believe, because he walked out to Stuart Broad, throwing his arms up, geeing up the Lord's spectators, And I think he was just absolutely flustered, got struck on the pad, wandered out of his crease, and Ollie Pope had the intuition to knock down the stumps at the striker's end and find him short. It was just baffling village cricket stuff. Even if it was in our division lock, we'd probably be mocking the batter relentlessly. But no, it was just the start of a horror day for Colin. Getting out Ben Stokes, only to be found to have overstepped. And then a couple overs later to suffer an injury, which I haven't actually checked this, but I think he's out of the series now, unfortunately. So a really tough day for Colin. And yeah, just one or two horrific moments for him just coinciding on the same day.
Yeah, I blame Foxy Rover for firing up Stuart Broad. He did a little bit this summer, and now Stuart Broad he's just leaning again into that being the antagonist, which is great. What are your do you give pass marks to Ben Stokes and Baz McCullum for their first tests as captain and coach? I mean, I'm not sure how much McCullum actually had to do before this test, but did you sense a change in the way England played at all, or do you think it was just a good close game of cricket?
There were certainly moments that were very much Ben Stokes branded moments, and one of them particularly was in that run chase in the fourth innings. He came out with England in a bit of trouble at 4 for 70 odd, and he just went straight on the attack. He was charging down the crease. He was playing his shots almost in one day mode, and all of a sudden you look up and himself and Joe Root have put on 80, 90 runs and the match is back in the balance. And he just seems to know how to handle a run chase. And I think Joe Root actually took some inspiration from that, because after Ben Stokes' dismissal, Root was going at a run a ball after his second 50 came off 50 balls. But other little moments I loved, when England took their ninth wicket in the second innings, he brought Matt Parkinson, the debutant, on. Because obviously leg spinners and the tail go hand in hand. Like, that was a really good opportunity for Matt Parkinson to get that first test wicket, which he did.
Yeah, I really enjoyed how England went about it in the field in particular. They felt like there was an extra bit of energy there. They were revitalized a little bit. And you saw some of the field placements. They had like 5 slips in at points. And still Stokes was mid-off, mid-on, just there chatting to the bowler. I really enjoyed the way he kind of had a chat to Matt Potts a lot of the time. Obviously, leading wicket taker for the match, took 7 wickets and is kind of on Scott Boland's coattails. But he's come on that. Ben Stokes knows well from county cricket at Durham, so he really kind of took him under his wing. And I think that was one of the things that impressed me the most about his first appearance as test captain, just the way he kind of guided Matthew Potts through it and really encouraged him to be himself and bowl the way that he knows how to bowl. And yeah, I like the look of Potts. I like the look of Stokes as a captain. And I think it's going to be a really interesting era for England cricket, because you kind of got some really good staples there that, sure, Jimmy Anderson, Stuart Broad, we don't know how much longer they're going to go around for, whether it's this summer, whether they make it through to the Ashes next year and call it quits. But after that, there's some really nice bits falling into place. Like, I really liked Crawley at the top of the order. He kind of really just that Warner-esque, or the way I say it, almost like a right-handed Matty Hayden, just kind of stands and delivers. Folks, I thought, was really clean behind the stumps. And yeah, Potts, Parkinson, it's great. I think it could be a really good era of England cricket if they can kind of just blood the right guys into the team and give them consistent game time and not do all this chopping and changing that we've seen over the last sort of 2-3 years.
Here's a bit of foreshadowing for you, Locke. Ashes 2026.
26?
Well, next time they're coming down to Australia. Oh. Is that 25, 26? Whenever that is.
No, I just thought you were going to go next year. But yeah, sure.
Well, I assume Anderson and Broad will still be there, but next time they come down to Australia, imagine Archer, Ollie Stone and Matt Potts as the pace trio at the Gabba.
Archer, Stone and Potts sounds like a homeware store.
A trip down to Bunnings. That's fantastic. But no, as you said, really exciting for the future of England cricket, and you know, 2 more test matches in this series. Thank goodness. Last time New Zealand went over, it was just a 2-match series.
Yeah, Joe Root is back up to number 2 in the test batting rankings. Kane Williamson has slipped. So, yeah, plenty to keep an eye on there. Kyle Jamieson's still taking plenty of wickets as well, which is nice. So, yeah, second test starts Friday evening, 8 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. Then the third test isn't for a sort of a fortnight after that. So we'll take a quick break. That's all the big international series for the men. And we'll come back talking about some of the big news out of the women's game and also domestic T20. really interesting comments out of the UK over the last week, Nick, from the ICC's independent chair, Greg Barclay, who had this to say about women's cricket. To play test cricket, you've got to have structures domestically that allow you to play long-form cricket, and they don't really exist in any of the countries at the moment. So I can't really see women's test cricket or long-form cricket evolving at any particular speed at all. I don't see it as part of the landscape moving forward to any real extent. Nick, controversial comments. I don't particularly think they're new comments. It's felt like the ICC has always insisted that white ball cricket is going to be the focus for growing the women's game. But it is just disappointing to hear that after a summer where we've had some of the best women's test cricket that we've had ever, that there's still, it doesn't seem like there's any flexibility or any room to move for them to go, you know what, there's an appetite for women's test cricket. So let's at least try and give it a platform to grow.
Yeah, I mean, he is right in an extent that at the moment, there just isn't a place for test cricket for most of the playing nations at the moment. Like, for example, Pakistan's coming out to Australia this upcoming summer, and they're just not in a position where they're able to play test cricket. But it is so disappointing, and it really knocks the wind out of the sails to hear the head of the ICC sound so despondent and negative about the future of the game. I mean, there's been such a push, particularly from Australia, India and England, to try and revive test cricket. And even though it isn't the money maker at the moment, we know that in 10, 15 years, it does have the potential to be that in the Australian landscape if, you know, if we give them an opportunity. But he is right in that there isn't a domestic landscape for long format cricket. Like most of these, even in Australia, most of them don't play any red ball cricket. We spoke last summer about how the likes of Annabelle Sutherland and Darcy Brown hadn't even played with a red ball for several years before the test match against England down in Canberra. His worst comments were about Afghanistan. He essentially called the situation in Afghanistan a blip in the road, which is just like, we've seen so many reports of athletes in Afghanistan in hiding, fleeing the country, receiving death threats. And to call it a blip in the road is just so disrespectful, I think, to the situation over there with the Taliban regime taking over. And yeah, what were your thoughts, Locke? I'm just a little bit befuddled by all this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the Afghanistan comments are clearly, they're awful. I think it's so much more nuanced and complicated than that in a geopolitical sense, that while cricket's important in that context, it's important to look at women's rights more generally in what's happening there. And cricket has an important role to play there. And by calling it a blip in the road is really underplaying what's happening there. But yeah, in terms of what's happening with women's cricket and the growth of the game, we've seen domestically here in Australia, spoke with quite a lot of players around the last test summer for the women. And while a lot of them would like to play more red ball cricket, it was interesting chatting to the likes of Meg Lanning, Elise Villani, kind of these players who have been around the scene for a while. Their immediate priority was definitely the growth of the WNCL. And we saw in the most recent MOU, the one-year extension that they've agreed to for this year, that that's the big thing. That's the big change, that we're going to see a full WNCL where each team will play each other twice. And I think that was a big push this season. And seeing that step taken when players are calling for it is good, because it's showing the players' voice is being listened to. But yeah, test cricket, it just feels like a frontier that it's there to be explored for women's cricket, that there just needs to be something done about it. And yeah, I really hope that into the future we see something done about it, because everyone loved that test against England down in Manuka, that last finish, Alana King bowling that last over of the day looking for that one final wicket, was fantastic. And I think we deserve more of it. But speaking of what is deserved and what players deserve, especially women's players, a great article by our colleague Ben Horn over at the Daily Telegraph this week about the shock pay gap between Australia's men's and women's cricketing stars. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that one, Nick?
Well, yeah, essentially it really exposed the massive disparity between the men and women. In short, the men are making tenfold what the national women make on their contract. Even Pat Cummins's captaincy bonus, which is about 200K, is more than Meg Lanning's entire contract. Meg Lanning makes less than any of the 16 men on the men's contract list. So, for example, she makes less than the likes of Cameron Green, Alex Carey, Marcus Stoinis. I don't know. What were your thoughts, Locke? It was a bit of a shock to read, actually.
Yeah, it is a shock. Obviously, people are going to point to the revenue that the women's game brings in, the sponsors and things like that. But I think especially with this women's cricket team, they're one of the most popular teams in the country, that you've got so many big profile brands coming on to sponsor them. You've got CommBank, you've got Cadbury, you've got, there's just limitless brands who are wanting to get behind this women's team. And it just feels like the gap shouldn't be that much. I don't think anyone's saying that Meg Lanning should be earning $2 million like Pat Cummins is, because Pat Cummins, a lot more responsibilities. The men's team do play a lot more cricket, and that goes back to our last point we're talking about, because there's more countries who Australia can play against in different formats and different series. But the gap is just astounding, and it shouldn't be anywhere near that 10% mark. It's really disappointing. And while it's great to see players like Alyssa Healy and obviously Elise Perry in particular, who have become such marketable assets that they can front advertising campaigns and earn funds that way, this team shouldn't have to be doing that to make up for the gap. And whether it's requiring further investment from Cricket Australia, whether it's about when the next MOU comes around and Australian Cricketers Association kind of working on the pay scheme and what's happening there between the men's and the women's players, because this isn't the choice from the men's players to be earning this much more money either. It's just the system that they're in. It's going to need a lot of discussing by the time the next MOU comes around. And I think it's why they were so happy to just, Cricket Australia in particular, to have a 12-month MOU. The ACA kind of admitted that, okay, look, we got through COVID. We understand things are still being sorted out. So let's just do a short-term one. So by the time the negotiations start next year, it's going to be, I think the discussions are going to be a little bit more vigorous.
Yeah, I guess looking ahead to other news around Australia, Taylor Vlemenik is on the move, Lock.
Yeah, she is heading back to Melbourne. The Renegades have picked up the speedster, who we hopefully will see a lot more of this summer. It's so disappointing that she didn't get to play much of a role during the Ashes after making that comeback in the T20 match. Hopefully we'll see Taylor back in action for a full BBL campaign for the Hurricanes. Fingers crossed there. And another big move, Heather Graham, who was fantastic for the Scorchers last year in their title-winning campaign, got called up to the Australian team as a reserve player for the recent World Cup in New Zealand. She has gone down to the Scorchers. She's gone from the Scorchers, down to the Hurricanes. So a great sort of international caliber replacement there for Taylor Vlemenik. So some good moves there in the WBBL, which the season, it's June, we're only a couple months away. It'll be here before we know it, which is really exciting. But we've got to stay on T20 cricket. And before we get into some of the big news about the competitions going, the Hurricanes, who, again, we've just been talking about a fair bit, they've brought in a big consultant for their men's team, Nick.
Yeah, just announced while we were recording this podcast, actually. The great Ricky Ponting has signed on as a head of strategy for the Hurricanes. I'm literally just reading the press release now. He says, "The competition and the game itself has changed enormously since I played, and I know so much more about the nuances and the T20 game now than I did then. I'm passionate about the progression of Tasmanian and Australian cricket across all forms of the game. So to be asked to take on such a critical role for the Hurricanes is really special." As you mentioned off air, Lock, because of his media commitments, he won't be able to take on a coaching role. But regardless, exciting to see hopefully what Ponting can do with a team that, has really struggled in the BBL, actually. I mean, they've never won a title. They've made maybe one or two finals. But I feel like considering how much higher class talent there is in Tasmania, have somewhat underperformed in the BBL.
Yeah, I think hopefully he's the sort of guy who can turn it around. And he's made it clear that he believes that the couple of changes and they could win the comp. So Matthew Wade has obviously come off this IPL experience that he's won, which should help the Hurricanes. He can bring that sort of experience in. And obviously another story that's been reported in the last week or so is that Ponting going to the Hurricanes could open the door for Justin Langer to coach the team. Obviously he's out of a job at the moment. The Hurricanes are still on the search for a coach. So he could be the guy who they turn to kind of bring that winning mentality back. And we obviously know what he was able to achieve with the Scorchers during his time there. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what the Hurricanes can do, how they can turn it around. But I guess the bigger issue for the Big Bash generally at the moment is they've got a lot of competition this year. They're going to have to struggle. Well, they're going to struggle attracting the big international players. With obviously, we knew about the Cricket South Africa T20 tournament that was going to be from sort of mid-January onwards, but we've just discovered this week that the UAE Emirates Cricket has confirmed that they're planning to launch a T20 league that'll start in January 2023.
Yeah, I think it's fair to assume that the contracts, the player contracts for that UAE competition will be pretty nice, pretty gorgeous, actually. And we've already seen on Twitter Chris Lynn hinting at his interest of joining that UAE competition, which, needless to say, would be a massive loss for the Big Bash. But now we have, in this January time slot, three high-paying T20 tournaments, and I think it's fair to say that it's worrisome for BBL fans. It's a problem. I mean, we haven't seen David Warner play a Big Bash game for 6-7 years. Do you think he's in a position where he might go off and captain a UAE side instead of playing the Big Bash? I mean, it's been spoken a lot about the fact that he is still banned from captaincy in the Big Bash. There's been a push for him to hopefully have the opportunity to captain again, whether it is the Thunder or another franchise. But he might look at the Big Bash and think, I can't captain the side. The paychecks aren't, you know, overly impressive. What's stopping him from instead going over to the UAE or even South Africa?
When you're going to be earning more than 100K a week, yeah, definitely, especially in the UAE. And it's interesting, tried to reach out to Chris Lynn for a bit of a comment this week, and he was keen just to go, no, I'm happy to chat once my negotiations are over. So he's still on the table. I'm sure there's still plenty of Big Bash clubs that aren't the Brisbane Heat who are looking to get his signature for this year. But obviously there's some thought that what we'll see with the international players is that they'll be signing contracts for the front end of the tournament of the Big Bash. And then once the UAE league starts, they'll be heading over there. And I guess the hope is that when they leave, the Australian test players will be able to come back into the Big Bash fold. So there'll be kind of a replacement thing, which I guess is a best case scenario considering, but also it feels like we do need a solution eventually where we get both the best caliber of international players and our test players playing in the same teams, just to really bring the Big Bash league up to scratch. But it feels like this season, there's a few things really pressuring the Big Bash to take a step back up to the next level. And whereas the last few years, it's sort of cantered along and we've gone, okay, what can we do to fix it? What do we do? And there's been a couple of changes and tweaks. This year, it really feels like okay, we need to make some serious changes to keep the quality of this competition alive. And I feel like slowly behind the scenes, we're seeing that happen. Obviously, there's talk of this international player draft for the Big Bash that looks set to be kind of locked in the next few weeks. And that'll mean the international players are locked in before the UAE tournament is locked in. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the Big Bash. And whether it's a make or break season, I don't know. But it definitely feels like that there's more writing on the wall for the tournament than there has been in previous seasons.
Well, I think this is the last Big Bash season before the new broadcast deal. So if they have to nail this summer, it has to be perfect. Otherwise, Cricket Australia could be staring down the barrel of a huge financial loss, because I don't know how keen Channel 7 is to sign on again. I mean, there's every chance that the Big Bash might be going behind the Foxtel paywall. This is just speculation, but I don't know. Like, will Channel 9 maybe taking a stab at the Big Bash? Will Channel 10 come back into the fore? Regardless, this summer has to be a hit. Otherwise, you know, I can't see Cricket Australia earning anywhere near as much as they did in the previous deal 5-6 years ago. But anyway, that's a problem for another, that's a conversation for another day. But Locke, before we wrap up, there's one thing I do need to mention. We saw one of the more remarkable scorecards in professional cricket this week. Nepal, the under-19 women's T20 side in their World Cup Asia qualifier, up against, coincidentally, the United Arab Emirates, all out 4-8.
Oh.
Bowled out in 8.1 overs, six players dismissed for a duck. The top score was 3. And UAE teenager Mahika Gur taking 5-2. And they chased it, of course, in 7 deliveries without losing a wicket. So one of the more dominant performances I've seen in a T20 World Cup qualifier. But no, it certainly looks like UAE, they've been killing it so far in this competition. It looks like they'll be the ones progressing to the under-19 World Cup in, I think it's in South Africa next year.
Yeah, I mean, Scotty Boland area is almost that.
Almost.
But yeah, great to see. Obviously, the more that we see these countries competing in under-19s and not just in sort of the qualifiers for World Cups, like I think it's really important that we're seeing them in the junior representative pathways as well. So I think it's a really good thing for cricket. And my final piece of news that I want to touch on before we wrap up is Mitali Raj, obviously the Indian legend, 39 years old. She's finally called time on her playing career, a playing career that has spanned now 4 decades. She made her debut. What was the date? Made her debut for in ODI cricket, June 26, 1999. So she has played 232 ODIs for India, 7 centuries, an average of 50.6 across 4 decades. That's really just remarkable. And obviously a stalwart of the game. One of the best to ever do it, almost 8,000 career runs. I think many were calling for her to maybe be dropped from the Indian team before the last World Cup, but it was great that she got to, She did her best to try and get that team into that final series and just fell short against the West Indies, or with the West Indies getting in instead. But a legend of the game, someone who has had an impact on so many players. I mean, looking at the tributes yesterday after she announced her retirement, so many of the current greats of the game have gone, Mitali, what an inspiration you've been. So, yeah, a true changing of the guard moment, considering you've got a player who was playing in the 90s who has finally announced her retirement.
Point of comparison, do you have that the date of her ODI debut there, Lock?
I do. It was June 26,
1999. So Cameron Green was born in 1999 in June on the 3rd. So Cameron Green is only about 2 or 3 weeks older than Mitali Raj's international career, which is just quite baffling to hear. But no, a remarkable career, obviously. As you said, the tributes on social media were overwhelming, actually. So a change of the guard, all the best for her, and whatever she decides to do next with her career. Will she go into coaching, into media? We'll have to wait and see. But a remarkable career, a stunning career, actually. She's she was part of that sort of first era of T20 cricket in sort of the mid-noughties. She's surely played a part in growing the T20 game of women's cricket as well. And I mean, the numbers speak for itself. Tens of thousands of international runs, and all congratulations to Mitali Raj.
We salute you, Mitali Raj. What a career. That's everything for the Boundary Rider podcast this week. Make sure to check us out on all the social channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. We'll be putting a few clips there throughout the week, and feel free to email us, boundaryriderpod@gmail.com, I should say, rather. I've been Lachlan McCurdy. Nick Savage has been with me as always. And make sure to subscribe to the podcast as well. Leave us a comment and a rating while you're there. Nick, what are you working on this week?
Well, a lot of 6 a.m. shifts this week for me, unfortunately. But obviously, I'll be keeping an eye on all the cricket. But plenty of NRL, AFL, all that jazz is happening. And one thing I do want to look into a bit more is just the food and petrol shortages in Sri Lanka and the sort of the crisis that's happening over there. Maybe that's something we can delve into in next week's podcast. There's been a lot of talk about the situation in Sri Lanka, and admittedly, I don't know enough about it. So maybe that's something for us to look into over the next few days.
Yeah, definitely. We might look into trying to chat to someone on the ground over there. Nick, pleasure as always. Thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next week.